Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 o'clock, and I'm your host today, Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a political magazine for the radio. We offer an hour of interviews, commentaries, reviews, music, and other sorts of audio experiences about history, culture, the economy, politics, the environment. We put the spotlight on democratic movements and on the most militant democratic tendencies of our liberation and justice-oriented movements. We look at everyday culture with a critical but appreciative eye. We talk about movies and books and music and try and show you both what will inspire and enlighten you. But we also try to deconstruct the spectacles of capitalist society, patriarchy, white supremacy, heteronormativity, to name a few. On today's show, we start with Bill Resnick talking to Patricia Smith, a former organizer and lobbyist with the Oregon School Employees Association. They'll consider the plight of workers in our schools who are not teachers but make less than $15 an hour. They reflect on the run-it-like-a-business philosophy driving down their wages and working conditions, but also their importance to our children's education and well-being. We're talking about the people who feed your children, who keep a clean and safe environment for your children, but also those who help our children learn when our teachers are stretched too thin. After that, we'll hear a short documentary from the School of Life YouTube channel about Karl Marx's enduringly relevant ideas about alienation, exploitation, ideology, and of course the economy. Following that, book mole Larry Bolden reviews a work of nonfiction by Elizabeth Short, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Bill Resnick returns briefly to talk with Jim Cook about the Just Transition Project and Forum coming to Portland. And to conclude today's 4th of July Old Mole, Fran Michelle reflects on the burning history of African-American oratory, from Frederick Douglass's famous speech about what the 4th of July means to a slave, to Jesse Williams' recent Black Entertainment Television Award acceptance speech. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically operated radio station. You can find the Old Mole on KBOO's website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We're on Facebook and Twitter, and if you have any questions or comments or would like to get involved in making radio with us, we can be reached at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. And now, here's Bill Resnick and Patricia Smith.
Hi, Patricia Smith. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Patricia Smith was an organizer and lobbyist for the Oregon School Employees Association, very recently retired. She began that work right after she was defeated in an election to retain her seat in the legislature. She had won that seat in the year 1990, representing Salem Kaiser. Before that, she was on the Salem City Council, and before that, a neighborhood activist. It was a swing district. The Republicans hated her. In fact, it was a district. She had won the district from the former Republican leader in the state legislature. And they spent really a lot of money in a year that Republicans were winning, 1994. Anyway, in her legislative career, she was known as a tireless bulldog of a worker for working people. When she lost office, she was a single mother, and after a year or so caught on with the OSEA, that is the Oregon School Employees Association, and she continued her work as a lobbyist and organizer. Recently, I went to a dinner party sponsored by the Northwest Workers Justice Project. They offer legal assistance to low-income workers, many immigrants without all the documents. They do it on matters of wage theft, safety, retaliatory firings, abusive debt collection, all kinds of things, access to medical care, and, of course, other miseries inflicted on the poor in this society. In the ceremony, after some eating and getting a little tipsy, and also after having years of working in the legislature alongside Patricia Smith, who also they put on the board, she was one of the founders, actually, the Northwest Workers Justice Project awarded their highest honor to Patricia Smith, Tribune of Worker Justice. So, Tribune of Worker Justice Smith, tell us about the people you represented in Salem and what you and your allies, including the NWJP, do as lobbyists in the legislature.
Well, I worked for a union, a public sector and private sector union, and they represent predominantly classified school employees working in Oregon's public sector schools. Classified meaning they're not certified teachers, they are not administrators. They're everybody else in a school, so that you can think of like secretaries, school bus drivers. About 40% of their membership are educational assistants. They are the people who provide direct instruction, one-on-one teaching to special ed kids. They get behavioral kids. Anybody who can't be in a mainstream classroom for the whole day, generally educational assistants have some part in their teaching.
Oh, really?
So that's who I represented.
Oh, and sometimes, and they're one-on-one with troubled kids, I gather.
The hardest kids to teach are the ones that my folks teach.
Uh-huh. And my sense is of those people, like the school lunch people, all of them, you also do the maintenance people? Are they also in the union?
Custodians, maintenance,
right.
Technology, food service.
They're extremely poorly paid.
Very. Minimum wage workers, many of them.
You know, we talked a little bit earlier. I was sort of shocked. No, I wasn't shocked. I sort of wondered about it. The school districts are the worst employers, the cheapest employers, the most maneuvering employers, right?
Classified school employees, for the most part, take these jobs because they want to work with children and they want to work in schools, and they're willing to sacrifice to do it. Many of them, many of my educational assistants, for example, were certified teachers, but they didn't want to stand in front of a classroom of 40 kids hoping some of them got the lesson. They wanted to provide one-on-one instruction with students who need the help. So they took a position that pays far less than a certified teacher so that they could do that kind of work with kids. So these are people who are there for the kids. That makes them vulnerable to their employer.
Yeah, I've often thought of like the school lunch people, all of those people, the custodians, they're very important in creating the school culture, right? Because the teachers are often want to maintain their authority, so aren't like friends with the kids. It's a little harder.
They don't have time.
But all of those people, like the school lunch people that you interact with all the time, who then learn the kids' names, and for young kids, all of those relationships, I think, are very important.
They are. Bill, that's why I worked for them for 20 years. I myself have learning disabled children. And my youngest son we were told by the doctors in the Child Development Center at OHSU that he would never be able to read in spite of his very high intelligence. And an educational assistant taught him to read. And he ended up graduating with honors and a double major from college. And it was an educational assistant that saved that kid. So, and, you know, custodians, schools don't have counselors anymore. They don't have social workers in them. They don't have people to help kids. And they have every child now goes to public school. And 150 years ago, every child didn't go to public school. The ones who couldn't fit into the mainstream classroom didn't go there. And that's not the way it is now. They get everything in school. They get major illnesses. They get mental health issues. They get drug and alcohol addiction issues. They get all of that. And sometimes when those kids reach out to an adult, the adult they reach out to is the one they feel they can trust. And that may not be the person of authority in the classroom or in the school. They may see the custodian as someone they can trust and they can talk to.
The school is this little society.
It's the whole world.
Yeah. And, of course, the school districts don't understand that. And, of course, the teachers are... There are many more teachers, and they have much more money, the OEA, the Oregon Education Association, and they're fighting for decent pay for their teachers. And often the people you represented are left out, it seems to me. It's sort of shameful in some ways, but that's what happens.
We so dramatically underfund our education system when we understand that it is the number one component of a civilization, and it keeps us out of a third world. But that's the situation we're in. And I think that there are some administrators and superintendents who really don't care about some of their staff. But I think for the most part, they're just caught in this catch-22. They have to provide the best education they can for the students, and they're doing it in a world that diminishes every year in terms of resources. So they're doing it with far less staff than they had when I was in school, or when my kids were in school, for that matter. And they are suppressing everyone's salary. For a teacher, you have to have a master's degree to be a teacher in Oregon, and then you walk into a classroom for $50,000 a year. You're never going to pay off your student loans at that rate. And so that's ridiculous. It doesn't work. And for my members, they're hourly wage workers, and they suppressed those wages as much as they could. They replaced those workers. They laid them off and only replaced those that they had to. They've replaced them with temporary workers that they don't have to pay benefits to. And it's all short-term, get us through this school year kind of thinking that causes the long-term drain of quality of our education system. But we may not see it if you're not working in the school.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Tricia Smith, a Tribune of Worker Justice, also on the board of the NWJP. They work together with the Oregon School Employees Association that Tricia Smith recently retired from. Tricia, tell us about what happened in the minimum wage struggle in Salem recently.
I've been involved in every minimum wage increase fight we've had since 1990, and this was the only serious effort in the legislature. The legislature, I think, took up the issue because it was pretty clear that a good campaign could pass a $15 minimum wage. And that was what my union was fighting for, increasing the minimum wage statewide for everyone and making it $15.
$15 would raise the pay of a lot of the people you represent, too. It would raise it greatly.
Yes, it would. It would raise it greatly.
In fact, some of your people are just getting the minimum wage, right? What percent?
Oh. The further east you go, the higher the percentage is.
Uh-huh.
But we have minimum wage workers in the metro area, food service workers, for example. The other thing that school districts do is they reduce their hours. So they may be making $10 an hour, but they used to work 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day, and now they work 4 hours a day. Or they work even less than that. Some school districts, I've had members who have their time on the job reduced to 3 hours and 45 minutes. And the reason it's 3 hours and 45 minutes is because they would have to pay them benefits if it were 4 hours.
Ah, that's why they're the Walmart.
Why they're public, the Walmart of the public sector.
The public sector.
Minimum wage fight was a legislative fight this time. We had initiatives that were going to the ballot. The legislature knew that. And I think there were a lot of lobbyists for the business sector particularly who didn't want that to happen because we have won every minimum wage fight we took to the people. And they could see that. So they wanted the legislature to fix it. And that's what happened.
And you and your allies fought for...
We continued to fight for $15. Bit of a phase-in, but we did not support a tiered system where your wage depended on where you lived.
Tricia, let's conclude. Are you going to miss the legislative struggles?
I'm probably never going to stop advocating for people who need a voice, but I will not miss the huge workload and the ever-diminishing opportunity that I see for people. We can turn that around when we all stand up, make our legislators accountable. Even the Democrats, even the progressive Democrats, need a nudge from their constituents.
And from people like you. You know, what we'll have to talk about next, and we don't have time, but we'll do it, is what you see as the impact now of, it's sort of known as a Sanders campaign, but it's much more than that, than Bernie Sanders. It's a whole new set of understandings of a vast number of people from below that the old system was really taking advantage of them and making them horribly insecure and often hungry. And now there's really, it seems to me, an organized fight back, at least the possibility of it.
I think it began with the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. Sanders tapped into that. We all need to stand up and fight for what we think. And I hate that word fight. We just need to demand that our world is what we want it to be.
And the Occupy movement, and even before the Occupy movement, all of those people, the real activists like you, the visionaries, the fighters in the labor movement, and many other movements sort of prepared the ground. Anyway,
that's
we have to end, but we'll talk again. Tricia Smith, thanks so much for talking to us.
I enjoyed it, Bill. You call me anytime.
Good. Thanks. So long.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to the New York gubernatorial debate. I'll be your DJ this evening. Take it away.
I represent the rent's too damn high party. People working 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, some a third job. Why? The rent is too damn high. The people I'm here to represent can't afford to pay the rent. Cause rent is too damn high. The people being laid off right now, can't eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Only a governor like a father of a house can put everything in control.
the bottom line is the economic state of emergency is the way to go. The way to go. The go. This will reduce the cost. You cut the rent down. You cut the taxes down. To give business owners the chance to hire people. To give business owners the chance to hire people. That is it. Nothing else to be said. In the subject, there's nothing else to talk about. Some say I'm a one-inch mechanic, but it all boils down to one thing. Rent is too damn high. The people I'm here to represent can't afford to pay the rent. Cause rent is too damn high.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That last song goes out to my friend Daisy, who just got another $100 rent increase. The song was a Gregory Brothers remix of some famous TV clips of the Rent is Too Damn High parties. Jimmy McMillan, which is just another example of fiery black oratory that we are going to hear on today's show. Stay tuned later as we hear a bit more on that from Old Mole Fran Michelle. Up next, we're going to listen to a documentary that can be found on the School of Life YouTube channel. It's about Karl Marx and, I think, compellingly portrays his central ideas and criticisms about how capitalism works both in theory and in practice.
Most people agree that we need to improve our economic system somehow. Yet we're also often keen to dismiss the ideas of capitalism's most famous and ambitious critic, Karl Marx. This isn't very surprising. In practice, his political and economic ideas have been used to design disastrously planned economies and nasty dictatorships. Nevertheless, we shouldn't reject Marx too quickly. We ought to see him as a guide whose diagnosis of capitalism's ills helps us to navigate towards a more promising future. Capitalism is going to have to be reformed. And Marx's analyses are going to be part of any answer. Marx was born in 1818 in Trier in Germany. Soon he became involved with the Communist Party, a tiny group of intellectuals advocating for the overthrow of the class system and the abolition of private property. He worked as a journalist and had to flee Germany, eventually settling in London. Marx wrote an enormous number of books and articles, sometimes with his friend Friedrich Engels. Mostly, Marx wrote about capitalism, the type of economy that dominates the Western world. It was, in his day, still getting going, and Marx was one of its most intelligent and perceptive critics. These were some of the problems he identified with it. Modern work is alienated. One of Marx's greatest insights is that work can be one of the sources of our greatest joys. But, in order to be fulfilled at work, Marx wrote that workers need to see themselves in the objects they have created. Think of the person who built this chair. It's straightforward, strong, honest, and elegant. It's an example of how, at its best, labour offers us a chance to externalise what's good inside us. But this is increasingly rare in the modern world. Part of the problem is that modern work is incredibly specialised. Specialised jobs make the modern economy highly efficient, but they also mean that it's seldom possible for any one worker to derive a sense of the genuine contribution they might be making to the real needs of humanity. Marx argued that modern work leads to alienation, Entfremdung. In other words, a feeling of disconnection between what you do all day and who you feel you really are and what you think you'd ideally be able to contribute to existence. Modern work is insecure. Capitalism makes the human being utterly expendable, just one factor among others in the forces of production, and one that can ruthlessly be let go the minute that costs rise or savings can be made through technology. And yet, as Marx knew, deep inside each of us, we don't want to be arbitrarily let go. We're terrified of being abandoned. Communism isn't just an economic theory. Understood emotionally, it expresses a deep-seated longing that we always have a place in the world's heart, that we will not be cast out. Workers get paid little, while capitalists get rich. This is perhaps the most obvious qualm that Marx had with capitalism. In particular, he believed that capitalists shrink the wages of the labourers as much as possible in order to skim off a wide profit margin. He called this primitive accumulation, ursprüngliche Akkumulation. Whereas capitalists see profit as a reward for ingenuity and technological talent, Marx was far more damning. Profit is simply theft, and what you're stealing is the talent and hard work of your workforce. However much one dresses up the fundamentals, Marx insists that at its crudest, capitalism means paying a worker one price for doing something and then selling it to somebody else at a much higher price. Profit is the fancy term for exploitation. capitalism is very unstable. Marx proposed that capitalist systems are characterized by a series of crises. Every crisis is dressed up by capitalists as being somehow freakish and rare and soon to be the last one. Far from it, argued Marx. Crises are endemic to capitalism, and they're caused by something rather odd. The fact that we're able to produce too much, far more than anyone needs to consume. Capitalist crises are crises of abundance, rather than, as in the past, crises of shortage. Our factories and systems are so efficient, we could give everyone on this planet a car, a house, access to a decent school and a hospital. And that's what so enraged Marx, but also made him so hopeful too. Few of us actually need to work, because the modern economy is so productive. But rather than seeing this need not to work as the freedom it is, we complain about it masochistically and describe it by a pejorative word, unemployment. We should call it freedom. There's so much unemployment for a good and deeply admirable reason, because we're so good at making things efficiently. We're not all needed at the coalface. But in that case, we should, thought Marx, make leisure admirable. We should redistribute the wealth of the massive corporations that make so much surplus money and give it to everyone. This is, in its own way, as beautiful a dream as Jesus' promise of heaven, but a good deal more realistic sounding. Capitalism is bad for capitalists. Marx didn't think that capitalists were evil. For example, he was acutely aware of the sorrows and secret agonies that lay behind bourgeois marriage. Marx argued that marriage was actually an extension of business, and that the bourgeois family was fraught with tension, oppression, and resentment, with people staying together not for love, but for financial reasons. Marx believed that the capitalist system forces everyone to put economic interests at the heart of their lives, so that they can no longer know deep, honest relationships. He called this psychological tendency commodity fetishism, Warenfetischismus, because it makes us value things that have no objective value. He wanted people to be freed from financial constraint so that they could, at last, start to make sensible, healthy choices in their relationships. The 20th century feminist answer to the oppression of women has been to argue that women should simply be able to go out to work. But Marx's answer was more subtle. This feminist insistence merely perpetuates human slavery. The point isn't that women should imitate the sufferings of their male colleagues. It's that men and women should have the permanent option to enjoy leisure. Why don't we all think a bit more like Marx? An important aspect of Marx's work is that he proposes that there's an insidious, subtle way in which the economic system colours the sort of ideas that we end up having. The economy generates what Marx termed an ideology. A capitalist society is one where most people, rich and poor, believe all sorts of things that are really just value judgments that relate back to the economic system. For example, that a person who doesn't work is worthless, that leisure beyond a few weeks a year is sinful, that more belongings will make us happier, and that worthwhile things and people will invariably make money. In short, one of the biggest evils of capitalism is not that there are corrupt people at the top. This is true in any human hierarchy. But that capitalist ideas teach all of us to be anxious, competitive, conformist, and politically complacent. Marx didn't only outline what was wrong with capitalism. We also get glimpses of what Marx wanted the ideal utopian future to be like. In his Communist Manifesto, he describes a world without private property or inherited wealth, with a steeply graduated income tax, centralized control of the banking, communication, and transport industries, and free public education. Marx also expected that communist society would allow people to develop lots of different sides of their natures. In communist society, it's possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. After Marx moved to London, he was supported by his friend and intellectual partner Friedrich Engels, a wealthy man whose father owned a cotton plant in Manchester. Engels covered Marx's debts and made sure his works were published. Capitalism paid for communism. The two men even wrote each other adoring poetry. Marx was not a well-regarded or popular intellectual in his day. Respectable, conventional people of Marx's day would have laughed at the idea that his ideas could remake the world. Yet, just a few decades later, they did. His writings became the keystone for some of the most important ideological movements of the 20th century. But Marx was like a brilliant doctor in the early days of medicine. he could recognize the nature of the disease, although he had no idea how to go about curing it. At this point in history, we should all be Marxists, in the sense of agreeing with his diagnosis of our troubles. But we need to go out and find the cures that really will work. As Marx himself declared, and we deeply agree, philosophers until now have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on. Come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Autumn Variety Hour on KBOO Portland.
And I'm your host, Joe Clement, for the Autumn Variety Hour. Before that, we heard a bit from Tupac singing about changes, and then a documentary from the School of Life YouTube channel. We'll post a link to that afterwards about Karl Marx and his political and economic theories and ideas. Up next, we're going to turn to bookmole Larry Bolden, who reviews a book of nonfiction this time, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Take it away, Larry.
Good morning. Instead of reviewing a work of fiction for you today, I'm going to talk about an astounding work by the scientist writer Elizabeth Colbert entitled The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Published in 2014, it won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 2015. Colbert explains to the reader that until the late 1700s, it was believed that prehistoric mass extinctions had never occurred. It was believed then that just as specification occurred gradually over immense periods of time, so too extinctions must occur only gradually, so gradually that given the tiny time period of Homo sapiens, it would be unlikely that even a single extinction could be witnessed. However, as geology has developed, it has become clear in the fossil record that there have been five catastrophic periods of mass extinctions. In the course of the book, she describes each of these, one caused by the Earth being hit by an asteroid, others by glaciation and/or global warming. Quoting from the book, "Very, very occasionally in the distant past, the planet has undergone change so wrenching that the diversity of life has plummeted. Five of these ancient events were catastrophic enough that they're put in their own category, the so-called Big Five. In what seems like a fantastic coincidence, it is probably no coincidence at all, the history of these events is recovered just as people come to realize that they are causing another one. While it is still too early to say whether it will reach the proportions of the Big Five, it becomes known as the Sixth Extinction. Mass extinctions are defined as events that eliminate a significant proportion of the world's biota in a geographically insignificant amount of time." Close quote. And she continues, "Conditions change so drastically or so drastically and so suddenly that evolutionary history counts for little." Close quote. While there's always a background rate of extinction, it is nothing like the rate of mass extinctions. For example, again quoting, "Today, amphibians enjoy the dubious distinction of being the world's most endangered class of animals. It's been calculated that the group's extinction rate could be as much as 45,000 times higher than the background rate. Extinction rates among many other groups are approaching amphibian levels. It is estimated that one-third of all reef-building corals, a third of all freshwater mollusks, a third of sharks and rays, a quarter of all mammals, a fifth of all reptiles, and a sixth of all birds are headed towards oblivion." Close quote. What makes the sixth extinction stand out is that it's being caused by a single species of animal, human beings. Summing up in her final chapter, Colbert says, quote, "Right now, in the amazing moment that to us counts as the present, we're deciding, without quite meaning to, which evolutionary pathways will remain open and forever be closed. No other creature has ever managed this, and it will unfortunately be our most enduring legacy. The sixth extinction will continue to determine the course of life long after everything people have written and painted and built has been ground into dust, and giant rats have, or have not, inherited the earth, close quote. From what I've said so far, it may seem that this is a horribly depressing book to read. But in fact, Colbert's writing is so clear and her travels while writing and documenting her claims so incredible that I came away from the book feeling like I have a much firmer grasp of evolution than before. Not since Stephen Jay Gould's Ever Since Darwin have I learned so much about the continually unfolding story of the evolution of life on Earth. Each chapter presents the latest beliefs in geography, biology, astrophysics, but in a language even the layperson can understand. While the book is clearly a warning, it is not a warning of what will come, but a description of what has been happening for at least the last 200 years. Colbert quotes with admiration the Stanford ecologist Paul Ehrlich. Quote, in pushing other species to extinction, humanity is busy sawing off the limb on which it perches, close quote. As she meticulously lays out her case for the sixth extinction, she points out so many interesting little facts about Earth's history. For instance, in explaining why there's so much diversity in the many incarnations of the Amazon rainforest, some version of which has existed for millions of years, lots of time for diversity to accumulate, quoting, but by contrast, as recently as 20,000 years ago, nearly all of Canada was covered in ice a mile thick. So was much of New England, meaning that every species of tree now found in Nova Scotia or Ontario or Vermont or New Hampshire is a migrant that's arrived or returned just in the last 1,000 years. Close quote. Colbert has packed into 300 pages an amazing array of statistics and descriptions of scientific projects that left this reader on the edge of his chair, turning pages as if reading a mystery thriller. It is a great book, and one that we can all read and should all read. I've been talking about Elizabeth Colbert's The Sixth Extinction. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Rhiannon Giddens singing a song of her own composition based off of slave memoirs. It was actually about a slave who is about to be freed by soldiers coming into the plantation where he lived, and his mistress, the master, probably a woman, was saying, "Don't go, you're all I have. Don't tell them that I have sold your children." We'll hear a bit more about how it felt to be a slave on 4th of July today, Independence Day of this country, USA. Up next, we are going to turn it over to Bill again for a short talk with Jim Cook about the Just Transitions Project and the Forum coming to town. They are trying to combine basically economic justice ends with social justice and environmental justice ends.
Cook, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
Jim Cook is a Renaissance person. Served several periods as president of his local union of the National Association of Letter Carriers. He's a musician in the groups General Strike and the Mary Rose Trio, Beyond Little Boxes, it's called. And he organizes with Portland's Climate Jobs PDX organization. Jim Cook, tell us about the Just Transition movement and the two terrific events it is sponsoring this Thursday and Friday in Portland, along with Climate Jobs PDX. First, Jim, Just Transition. What's their goal?
Thank you, Bill. Just Transitions for Portland is, once again, thinking globally and acting locally. What we believe is that we have to take into our own hands the future and the present. And Just Transitions means that we look historically at what happened to communities, such as our Oregon mill jobs that went overseas in the 80s, and the raw logs were sent overseas and then brought back here to be sold. Well, the environmentalists got the blame for that instead of corporate America or the global economy. So what we're looking at is Just Transitions means we look ahead to the future where fossil fuel extraction will no longer be happening. And thus, those communities that are living on fossil fuel taxes or wages will be protected. There are ways of protecting the communities and the workers. Just Transitions deals with both the climate crisis and the economic crisis, which can't be separated. The economic policies of the past centuries, decades, whatever you want to discuss, have led us to this point of the climate crisis. So what we do is we look at the economic crisis, the unbridled capitalism of especially recent decades, and we say, okay, how do we adjust both economically and also socially how we live? And affordable housing is integral to all of these discussions, but also jobs that we can live with, renewable jobs. Why isn't every solar panel being installed a union job? That's what we're looking at with Just Transitions, is making sure that the communities and the workers are protected, not just the global corporations, especially not the global corporations. We want the communities protected.
Social services have been gutted in the United States. Poor people are poorer than ever, and the wage gap and income gaps are at unprecedented levels. And people in the third world, the people who run things in this country, are perfectly ready to see everybody else starve to death. They could become genocidal when the economy begins failing, and they become even more xenophobic and anti-immigrant and anti-third world people of color.
So there's a conference. It's more of a discussion with a panel on Thursday, July 7th from 7 to 9 p.m., and it's entitled A Just Transition for Portland, The Path from a Fossil Fuel Export Economy to a More Equitable Clean Energy Economy. The panelists are spectacular, wonderful, thoughtful, and have been active in this area for a long time. It's at the sanctuary of the First Unitarian Church of Portland, 1211 Southwest Main Street. It's sponsored by the Center for Sustainable Economy, Climate Jobs PDX, and Climate Action Coalition.
Joe Eli is one of the key people. He'd be speaking there. He's in the Labor Network for Sustainability. It's for Portland, but it's also sort of a template or a model. Every city in the world, in fact, is going to have to change itself quite radically. They're really the sources of greenhouse gas pollution. If we don't change the cities, we're lost. In fact, we're facing extinction unless we really change things. Portland is a place that can do it very quickly. He even has begun. Jim Cook, tell us about the Friday evening song speech. I went to one recently. It was really wonderful.
Joe Uline has been a labor activist at the national level for many decades. He has served key offices with the AFL-CIO, but he's also been a rank-and-file worker in the metal and construction industries. And he's been a 50-year member of my union, the American Federation of Musicians. And he will be singing, but also speaking. It's, as you mentioned, it's called song speech, a term he made up that he delivers wonderful message, but also music. He's a very talented musician, writes a lot of his own music. And it will be a free event. It's Friday, July 8th at 7 p.m. at the Musicians Hall, Local 99. And the address is 325 Northeast 20th. And that is just south of Sandy Boulevard. And for more information about this event or Climate Jobs PDX, you can call this number, 503-286-5850.
Jim, let's just summarize then. Thursday night at the Unitarian Church, which is what, on 12th and Salmon? Or is it 11th and Salmon?
The address they're giving is 1211 Southwest Main Street.
And Friday it's at the Musicians Hall, which is just a little bit south of Sandy on 20th Street. Jim Cook, looking forward to seeing you this Thursday and Friday.
Thank you, Bill. And if people want more information about Joe Uline, he did a wonderful interview in the Northwest Labor Press. They can go online. It's the October 2nd, 2015 interview where he says, organized labor has recognized the science and the severity of the problem and the short timeline we have to deal with it. But we have been very slow to take the necessary action.
Jim, you and so many others are taking the necessary action. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
thank you to you and KBOO.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks, Jim Cook, for letting us know about how to get involved with the Just Transition Project movement. Up next, we're going to hand it over to Old Mole Fran Michelle, who is going to offer us some excerpts of readings and some speeches that highlight the powerful tradition of African-American oratory in this country. Fran?
The 4th of July in the United States is not just a holiday when white people celebrate killing each other over land that wasn't theirs. It's about a document. It's about the contradictions and possibilities in the language of freedom and equality. The 4th of July is Independence Day, commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress, declaring the United States a nation separate from Great Britain. The second sentence of the Declaration states, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." These ideals look back to the French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man and forward to later attempts to extend and fulfill their spirit. The 1848 Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments corrected the gender of the assertion by declaring, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal." 100 years later, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights states that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. But as Hannah Arendt observed, not everyone is recognized as having the right to have rights. The irony of the U.S. Declaration of Independence was hard to miss. The praise of liberty and the declaration of all men's equality came from a group including slaveholders, who presumably did not see the people whom they held as slaves as equally deserving of the liberty they claimed for themselves. The abolitionist Thomas Day commented at the time, "If there be an object truly ridiculous in nature, it is an American patriot, signing resolutions of independency with one hand and with the other brandishing a whip over his affrighted slaves." So when Frederick Douglass was invited to speak on the occasion in 1852, 76 years after the Declaration, 34 years after Douglass's birth to an enslaved woman in Maryland, 14 years after Douglass escaped from slavery, 7 years after his British friends and supporters bought his freedom, and 9 years before the Civil War, he foregrounded that irony. Here's Danny Glover reading from that speech.
"Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and the natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sake and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light and my burden easy and delightful. But such is not the state of the case. I see it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine." At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty in which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and quality hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may. Search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
As you can hear, Douglas, in fact, did pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. His eloquent denunciation of a slave nation celebrating a declaration of purported liberty and equality forms part of a long tradition of black oratory, skillfully deploying ironic understatement, sarcasm, metaphor, allusion, a full panoply of rhetorical strategies to agitate for social and political change. He's calling on his listeners to take action to make the language of the Declaration a reality. One of the most recent instances of such fire and thunder, whirlwind and earthquake, is Jesse Williams' recent speech at the BET Awards, which at least one blogger suggests has set the media on fire and ignited a crucial spark in the African-American community. It has inspired a hashtag on Twitter, Jesse Williams Appreciation Day, and a poem by Alice Walker. Williams is best known as an actor, appearing regularly on Grey's Anatomy, a long-running multiracial cast drama created by Shonda Rhimes. But Williams is also known as an activist. He joined the Ferguson October protests and produced a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement. He produces Question Bridge, an art project about the experience of black men in America, works with Sankofa, an organization dedicated to ending racial injustice, and is on the board of the national civil rights organization, the Advancement Project. The eloquence and density of Williams' speech is itself an assertion of power, a testament to the importance of genuine education and the traditions of black linguistic skill and wordplay. He puns on the word brand to suggest commodity fetishism as a form of slavery. He alludes to the song Strange Fruit, made famous by Billie Holiday, to suggest cultural appropriation is a metaphorical lynching. He recasts the meaning of Abraham Lincoln's reference to the biblical verse, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," in order instead to highlight the systemic centrality of black oppression to the American project and the possibility and power of active resistance. He glances toward the historical invention of racial categories in the 18th century and registers the super-exploitation of black labor as the economic underpinning of the nation's wealth. And in his comments on police violence against people of color, he insists on the equal rights and freedom that the Declaration of Independence reserved for white men who owned property. You're listening to KBOO FM Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and on behalf of the Old Mole Variety Hour, I invite you to listen now to Jesse Williams accepting the BET Humanitarian Award.
Please, please. Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, BET. Thank you, Nate Parker, Harry, and Debbie Allen for participating in that. Before we get into it, I just want to say, you know, I brought my parents out tonight. I just want to thank them for being here, for teaching me the focus on comprehension over career, that they make sure I learn what the schools were afraid to teach us, and also to thank my amazing wife for changing my life. Now, this award This is not for me. This is for the real organizers all over the country, the activists, the civil rights attorneys, the struggling parents, the families, the teachers, the students that are realizing that a system built to divide and impoverish and destroy us cannot stand if we do. All right? It's kind of basic mathematics. The more we learn about who we are and how we got here, the more we will mobilize. Now, this is also in particular for the black women, in particular, who have spent their lifetimes dedicated to nurturing everyone before themselves. We can and will do better for you. Now, what we've been doing is looking at the data, and we know that police somehow manage to de-escalate, disarm, and not kill white people every day. So what's going to happen is we are going to have equal rights and justice in our own country, or we will restructure their function and ours. Now, I got more, y'all. Yesterday would have been young Tamir Rice's 14th birthday. So I don't want to hear any more about how far we've come when paid public servants can pull a drive-by on a 12-year-old playing alone in a park in broad daylight, killing him on television and then going home to make a sandwich. Tell Rakia Boyd how it's so much better to live in 2012 than it is to live in 1612 or 1712. Tell that to Eric Garner. Tell that to Sandra Bland. Tell that to Dorian Hunt. Now, the thing is, though, all of us in here getting money, that alone isn't going to stop this. All right? Now, dedicating our lives to getting money just to give it right back for someone's brand on our body, when we spent centuries praying with brands on our bodies, and now we pray to get paid for brands on our bodies. There has been no war that we have not fought and died on the front lines of. There has been no job we haven't done. There's no tax they haven't levied against us, and we've paid all of them. But freedom is somehow always conditional here. You're free, they keep telling us. But she would have been alive if she hadn't acted so free. Now, freedom is always coming in the hereafter. But you know what, though? The hereafter is a hustle. We want it now. And let's get a couple things straight, just a little side note. The burden of the brutalized is not to comfort the bystander. That's not our job. All right, stop with all that. If you have a critique for the resistance, for our resistance, then you better have an established record of critique of our oppression. If you have no interest in equal rights for black people, then do not make suggestions to those who do. Sit down. We've been floating this country on credit for centuries, yo. And we're done watching and waiting while this invention called whiteness uses and abuses us, burying black people out of sight and out of mind while extracting our culture, our dollars, our entertainment like oil, black gold, ghettoizing and demeaning our creations, then stealing them, gentrifying our genius, and then trying us on like costumes before discarding our bodies like rinds of strange fruit. The thing is that just because we're magic doesn't mean we're not real. Thank you.
Escalating. 'Twas a
minor traffic stop about not signaling. But the policeman broke the law when he started ordering. Sandra Bland put out that cigarette, she would not agree. Had to show her who's the boss, take her into custody. They drug you to that jail cell, though they had no right to just lock you up on charges that were so contrived. Assaulting an officer, assaulting you. In that same situation, what you gonna do? Hello, my beautiful kings and queens, she'd always say online. On a YouTube channel, Sandy spoke her mind about poverty, racism, depression too. And to just remind you, someone loves you. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement. I've been singing some music and spinning some tunes and interviews and commentaries and reviews. I hope you tune in next week from 9 to 10 to hear us do it all over again. I'd like to thank Bill Resnick and Jim Cook, as well as his other guest, Patricia Smith. I'd like to thank Fran Michelle for bringing us some amazing things to hear, and for Larry Bolden for reviewing The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. You can find us on the web in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. For the Old Mole, I've been Joe Clement.